The Call of Islam presents Distortions of Ashura.
Ashura, Popular Distortions and Our Responsibility by Martyr Murtaza Mutahhari. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise belongs to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and the Maker of all creation. And may peace and benedictions be upon His servant and messenger, His beloved and elect, our Master, our Prophet, our Sire, Abul Qasim Muhammad. May Allah bless him and his pure and immaculate and infallible progeny.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Fabima naqdhihim mithaqahum la'annahum wa ja'alna qulubahum qasiyah yuharrifuna al-kalima an mawadhi'ihi wa nasu hazzan mimma dhukiru bih.
I seek the refuge of Allah from the accursed Satan. So for their breaking their compact, we cursed them and made their hearts hard. They would pervert the words from their meanings, and they forgot a portion of what they were reminded of. Our discussion here concerns the distortions or tarifat relating to the historic event of Karbala. There have occurred various kinds of distortions in recounting the details of this great event. We shall carry out this discussion in four parts. The first will deal with the meaning of tarif, its various existing forms, while pointing out that such misrepresentations have occurred in the popular accounts of the historic episode of Ashura. The second part deals with the general factors responsible for tarif, that is, the causes which commonly lead to the distortion of events and issues in the world. Why do men misrepresent and distort events and issues, and occasionally personalities? In particular, what factors have played a distorting role in the narrative of the episode of Karbala? The third part consists of an explanation concerning the distortions that have crept into the narratives of this historic event. The fourth part deals with our duty, that of scholars and the Muslim masses in this regard. The first part of this discussion is about the meaning of tarif. What does tarif mean? The Arabic word tarif is derived from harrafa, meaning to slant, incline, alter, distort, misconstrue, which means to make something depart from its original or proper course and position. In other words, tarif is a kind of change and alteration, though it includes a sense not possessed by mere change and alteration. If you do something that prevents a sentence, a message, verse or passage from conveying the meaning that it ought to convey, it gives it some other sense. You have subjected it to tarif. For instance, you make a statement before someone. Elsewhere, he quotes you. And later on you're told that so-and-so has reported that you have made such a statement. You find out what you have said was very different from what was reported. He has interpolated your statement, deleting words which conveyed your intent, and adding others on his own account, with the result that your statements have been distorted and totally altered. Then you would say that this person has misrepresented your statements, especially if someone tampers with an official document. He is said to be guilty of causing tarif in it. These examples were meant to elucidate the meaning of the term tarif, and it does not need any further explanation or clarification. Now we shall take up the different forms of tarif. There are various kinds of tarif, the most important of which are tarif in words and tarif of meaning. Tarif of words occurs when the literal form of a statement is changed. For instance, when words and phrases are deleted or added to a statement, or the sequence of sentences is altered in such a manner as to change its meaning. In this case, tarif occurs in the outward form and the wording of a statement. Tarif of meaning occurs when one does not change the words which remain in their original form, but the statement is interpreted in a manner that is contrary to the intent of its speaker. It is interpreted in such a manner as to express one's own intent and not that of its author. The Noble Quran employs the term tarif specifically in relation to the Jews. A study of history shows that they have been the champions of tarif throughout the course of history. I do not know what kind of race this is that has such an amazing penchant for misrepresenting facts. Accordingly, they always take up professions in which they can distort and misrepresent events. From what I've heard, the world's well-known news agencies, which are perpetually quoted by the radios and newspapers, are exclusively in the hands of the Jews. Why? Because they can report the events as they wish. How amazing is the Quran's statement about them? This characteristic of the Jews, the tendency for tarif, is considered a racial trait by the Quran. In one of the verses of the Surah Al-Baqarah, the Quran declares,
أَفَتَطْمَعُونَ أَنْ يُؤْمِنُوا لَكُمْ وَقَدْ كَانَ فَرِيقٌ مِّنْهُمْ يَسْمَعُونَ كَلَامَ اللَّهِ ثُمَّ يُحَرِّفُونَهُ مِّنْ بَعْدِ مَا عَقَلُوهُ.
Are you then eager that they, i.e. the Jews, should believe in you, while a party of them had heard Allah's word, and then consciously misinterpreted it after they had understood it, and did that knowingly? This means, O Muslims, have you pinned your hopes on their telling you the truth? They are the same people who would go along with Moses and hear God's pronouncements. But by the time they returned to their people's midst to recount what they had heard, they would twist it out of shape. The tarif that they would carry out was not for the reason that they did not understand and so altered what they reported. No. They are an intelligent people, and they understand matters, the issues, very well. But despite the fact that they understand what they have heard, they would recount them in a distorted manner for the people. This is what tarif is, that is, distorting and twisting things out of their original shape, and they carried out tarif even in divine scriptures. In this context, in most of the cases, the Quran uses the very term tarif or expresses the matter in some other manner. However, the exegetists have pointed out that the Quranic reference to tarif in this context includes tarif in wording as well as in meaning. That is, some of the instances of corruption that have occurred in the scriptures at the hands of the Jews relating to the wording and some of them relating to the meanings and interpretation. As this involves a digression from my main topic, I do not wish to discuss this matter any further. Here I must point out that tarif also differs in respect of the subject involved. There is a time when tarif occurs in an ordinary speech, as when two persons misrepresent each other's words. But there are times when tarif takes place in a matter of great significance to society, such as when there is misrepresentation of eminent personalities. There are personalities whose words and deeds represent a sacred authority for the people, and whose character and conduct is a model for mankind. For instance, if someone were to ascribe to Imam Ali alayhi salam a statement that he did not make, or something he had not meant to say, that is very dangerous. The same is true if a characteristic or trait is ascribed to the Prophet, may peace be upon him, or one of the imams, when in fact that they had some other qualities, or when tarif occurs in a great historic event, which serves as a moral and religious authority, as a momentous document from the viewpoint of society's norms, is a criterion in matters of morality and education. It is a matter of incalculable importance and entails a crucial danger when tarif, whether in respect of words or meaning, occurs in subjects which are not of the ordinary kind. There is a time when someone tampers with a verse of Hafiz, or makes interpolations in an animal fable. This is not so important, though, of course, one should not tamper with the books of literary value. These analogies have no relation at all to the theme. Of course, such a thing should not happen. But these interpolations do not harm a society's life and felicity and do not cause deviance in its course. But when tarif occurs in things that relate to the people's morality and religion, it is dangerous. And this danger is incalculable when it occurs in documents and matters that constitute the foundations of human life.
برای ما مردم خواهی نخواهی یک حادثه بزرگ اجتماعی.
The event of Karbala is inevitably an event possessing great social meaning for us, and it has a direct impact on our morality and character. It is an event that prompts our people without anyone compelling them to devote millions of man hours to listening to the related episodes and to spend millions of tumans for this purpose. This event must be retold exactly as it occurred without the least amount of interpolation. For if the smallest amount of interpolation takes place at our hands in this event, that would distort it, and instead of benefiting from it, we would definitely suffer harm. My point is that we have introduced thousands of distortions in retelling the narrative of Ashura, both in its outward form, that is, in respect of the very episodes and issues relating to the major events and the minor details, as well as in respect of their interpretation and meaning. Most regrettably, this event has been distorted both in its form and content. At times, a distorted version has at least some resemblance to the original. But there are times when the distortion is so thorough that the corrupted version has not the least resemblance to the original. The matter is not only distorted, but it is inverted and turned into its antithesis. Again, I must say with utmost regret that the misrepresentations that have carried out by us have all been in the direction of degrading and distorting the event and making it ineffective and inert in our lives. In this regard, both the orators and scholars of the Ummah, as well as the people, have been guilty. And God willing, we will elucidate all these matters. Marhum Haji Mirza Hussein Nuri, may God elevate his station, was the teacher of such figures as Marhum Haj Sheikh Abbas Kumi, Marhum Haji Sheikh Ali Akbar Nahawandi, and Marhum Haj Sheikh Muhammad Bakir Birjandi. He was a very extraordinary man and a muhadith, scholar of hadith, with an unparalleled command of his field and a prodigious memory. He was a man of fine spirituality with a highly fervent and passionate faith. Although some of the books that he wrote were not worthy of his station, and for this reason he earned the reproach of his contemporary scholars, but in general his books are good. And especially the one that he wrote on the topic of the mimbar, pulpit, entitled Lolo wa Marjan. Though a small book, it is an excellent work in which he speaks about the duties of those who deliver sermons and recount for the mourners the narrative of Karbala from the mimbar. The entire book consists of two parts. One part is about the sincerity of intention and purpose as one of the requirements for a speaker, orator, sermonizer, and Roza Khan is that the motive of someone who relates the narrative of Ashura should not be greedy or for attainment of pecuniary gain. How well he has discussed this topic. The second requirement is honesty and truthfulness. Here he elaborates on the topic of false and true narration, discussing various forms of lying in such a thoroughgoing manner that I do not think that there is any other book which deals with lying and its various forms in the way that it does, and perhaps there is no such other book in the whole world. In it he exhibits a marvelous learning and scholarship. In this book, that great man mentions several examples of falsehoods that have become prevalent in narratives of the historic event of Karbala. Those which I will mention are all or mostly the same things that the marhum Haji Nuri has lamented about. This great man even says explicitly, "Today too, we must mourn Hussein, but there are tragedies which have befallen Hussein in our era which did not occur in the past. They are all these falsehoods that are said regarding the event of Karbala and which no one opposes. One must shed tears for the sufferings of Hussein ibn Ali, not for the sake of the swords and the spears that struck his noble body on that day, but on the account of these falsehoods." In the book's introduction, he writes that an eminent scholar from India had written him a letter complaining about the false narratives that are recited in India, and asking him to do something or to write a book to stop the fictitious narratives that were current there. Then he remarks that this Indian scholar has imagined that the Roza Khans tell false stories when they go to India. He does not know that the stream is polluted from its very source. The center of false Roze are Karbala, Najaf, and Iran. That is, the very centers of Shiism. I will cite some instances of Tarif, of which a few relate to the events that occurred before Ashura, some during the days of his final halt at Karbala in the month of Muharram. I will also mention some of them that relate to the days of his family's captivity, and some about the Imams who lived after the event of Karbala. However, most of them will relate to the day of Ashura itself. It is essential to mention a point at first, and that is that the people are responsible in all these cases. You folks who attend the majlis sessions imagine that you have no responsibility in this regard and think that it is only the speakers who are responsible. The people have two major responsibilities. The first is that of Nahi Anil Munkar, forbidding what is wrong, which is obligatory for all. When they find out and know, and most of the time they do know, that a narrative is untrue, they should not sit in that gathering. It is forbidden to sit in such gatherings, and one must protest against them. Secondly, they must try to get rid of the eagerness and expectation which the hosts as well as the audience attending the majlis have for the majlis to become fervid, and there should be impassioned mourning, and the majlis should get feverish with cries of the mourners. The poor speaker knows that if he were to say only things that are true and authentic, the majlis will not get into a frenzy and the same people will not invite him again. Hence he is compelled to add something. The people should get this expectation out of their heads and refrain from encouraging the kind of fictitious narratives which kill the soul of Karbala and work up the mourners into a frenzy. The people should hear the true narrative so that their understanding and level of thinking is elevated. They should know that if a sentence creates a tremor in one's souls and attunes it with the spirit of Hussein ibn Ali, as a result, one small tear were to come out of one's eyes, it is really a precious station. But tears drawn by the scenes of mere butchery, even if a deluge, are worthless. The expectation of the people that the majlis should go wild with mourning is itself a source of falsehoods. Accordingly, most of the fabrications that have occurred have been for the purpose of drawing tears and nothing else. I have heard this story repeatedly, and you too must have heard it. Haji Nuri also mentions it. They say that one day Ali, the commander of the faithful, peace be upon him, was delivering a sermon from the minbar. Suddenly Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, said, "I am thirsty." Imam Ali said, "Let someone bring water for my son." The first person to get up was a little boy, Abul Fadl al-Abbas, peace be upon him. He went out and got a jar of water from his mother. When he returned carrying the jar on his head was drenched in water as it spilled from the sides. This story is narrated in its elaborate detail. Then, when the commander of the faithful's eyes fell on this scene, tears flowed from his eyes. He was asked why he was crying. He told them that the ordeals that this young son of his would face had come to his mind. You know the rest of the story, which serves the purpose of a point of departure for switching to the tragic scenes of Karbala. Haji Nuri has an excellent discussion at this point. He writes, "Now that you say that Ali was delivering a sermon from the minbar, you should know that Ali spoke from the minbar and delivered sermons only during the period of his caliphate. Hence, the episode must have occurred in Kufa. At that time, Imam Hussein was a man of about 33 years. Then he remarks, "Is it at all a sensible thing for a man of 33 years to say all of a sudden, in a formal gathering, while his father is delivering a sermon, 'I am thirsty and I want water'? If an ordinary man does such a thing, it would be considered ill-mannered of him. And moreover, Hazrat Abul Fadl, too, was not a child at that time, but a young man of at least 15 years. So you see how they have fabricated the story. Is such a story worthy of Imam Hussein? Aside from this fictitious character, what value does it have? Does it elevate the station of Imam Hussein, or does it detract from it? It is definitely detracting to the dignity of the Imam, as it ascribes a false act to the Imam and detracts from his station by bringing the Imam down to the level of a most ill-mannered person who at the time when his father, a man like Ali, is delivering a sermon, feels thirsty instead of waiting for the session to be over and suddenly interrupts his father's sermon to ask for water. One example of such fabrications is the story of a messenger who has brought a letter for Abu Abdullah, peace be upon him, and he awaits a reply. The Imam tells him to come after 3 days and collect the reply. After 3 days on inquiring, he is told that the Imam was departing the same day. He says to himself, "Now that he's setting out, let us go and watch the majesty and glamour of the Prince of the Hijaz." He goes, and there he sees the Imam, together with the other Hashimis, among men, seated on splendid chairs. Then the camels are brought, bearing the litters, draped in silk and brocade. Then the ladies emerge with much honor and ceremony. They are escorted into these litters. This description continues in this vein until they make the digression to switch to the scene of the 11th day of Muharram to compare the glamour and honor of this day with the sorry state of the womenfolk on the latter day. Haji Nuri calls such descriptions into question. He says, "It is history which says that when Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, left Medina, he recited this Quranic verse." He left in the state of fear and concern. That is, he likened his own departure to that of Moses, son of Imran, when he fled for the fear of the Pharaoh. He said, "It might be that my Lord will guide me to the right path." The Imam had departed with a most simple caravan. Does the greatness of Imam Hussein lie in his sitting, for instance, on golden chairs? Or does the greatness of his family and women folk lie in their using litters draped in silk and brocade? Or their possessing fine horses and camels and a retinue of lackeys and servants?
یکی از معروف‌ترین قضایا که یک تاریخ حتی به او گواهی نمی‌دهد قصه لیلا مادر حضرت علی اکبر است.
One example of tarif in the accounts of Ashura is the famous story of Layla, the mother of Hazrat Ali al-Akbar. a story that is not supported even by a single work of history. Of course, Ali Akbar had a mother whose name was Layla, but not a single historical work has stated that Layla was present at Karbala. But you see how many pathetic tales there are about Layla and Ali Akbar, including the story of Layla's arrival at Ali Akbar's side at the time of his martyrdom. I have heard this story even in Qum, in a majlis that had been held on behalf of Ayatollah Burujerdi, though he himself was not attending. In this tale, as Ali Akbar leaves for the battlefield, the Imam says to Layla, "I have heard from my grandfather that God answers a mother's prayer for the sake of her child. Go into a solitary tent, unfurl your locks, and pray for your son. It may be that God will bring our son safe back to us." First of all, there was no Layla in Karbala to have done that. Secondly, this was not Hussein's logic and way of thinking. Hussein's logic on the day of Ashura was the logic of self-sacrifice. All historians have written that whenever anyone asked the Imam for the leave to go to the battlefield, the Imam would at first try to restrain him with some excuse or another that he would think of, except the case of Ali Akbar, about whom they write, "Thereat he asked his father's permission to go forth to fight, and he gave him the permission." That is, as soon as Ali Akbar asked for permission, the Imam told him to depart. Nevertheless, there is no dearth of verses which depict the episode in quite a different light, including this one. "Rise, O father, let us leave this wilderness. Let us go now to Layla's tent." One case relating to the Tarif, which is also very amazing, is the one that I heard in Tehran. It was in the house of one of the eminent scholars of this city, where one of the speakers narrated the story of Layla. It was something which I had never heard in my life. According to this narrative, after Layla went into the tent, she opened the locks of her hair and vowed that if God were to bring Ali Akbar back safely to her, and should he not be killed in Karbala, that she would sow basil all along the way from Karbala to Medina, a distance of 300 farsangs. Having said this, he began to sing out this couplet, "I have made a vow where they too return, and I will sow basil all the way to Taft." This Arabic couplet caused me greater surprise as to where it came from. On investigating, I found that the Taft mentioned in it is not Karbala, but a place related to the famous love legend of Layla and Majnun. Taft was the place where the legendary Layla lived. This couplet was composed by Majnun al-Amari and sung for the love of Layla, and here this man was reciting it while attributing it to Layla, the mother of Ali Akbar, conjuring a fictitious connection with Karbala. Just imagine where a Christian or a Jew, or for that matter, some person with no religious affiliation, were to be there and hearing these things, will he not say, "What a nonsensical hagiography these people have"? He would not know that this tale has been fabricated by that man. And he would say, "Na'udhu Billah, how senseless were the women saints of these people to vow the sowing of basil from Karbala to Medina."
در همون گرما گرم روز عاشورا که میدونیم مجال نماز خوندنم نبود که امام نماز خوب
A worse fabrication is the one mentioned by Haji Nuri. As you know, in the heat of the battle on the day of Ashura, the Imam offered his prayers hurriedly in the form of Salat al-Khawf. The Sharia stipulates certain modifications in the obligatory Salat, the daily ritual prayers when offered in the conditions of war and the danger of the enemy's attack. The Salat thus offered is referred to as Salat al-Khawf. See the Quran, chapter 4, verse 101. And there was no respite even to offer full prayers. In fact, two of the companions of the Imam came to stand in front of him to shield the Imam against the arrows, so that he may offer two rakahs of Salat al-Khawf. The two of them fell from the injuries inflicted under the shower of the arrows. The enemy would not even give the respite for offering prayers. Nevertheless, they have concocted a story that Imam called for a wedding ceremony on this day, declaring, "It is my wish to see one of my daughters wedded to Qasim." Obviously, one cannot take one's wishes to one's grave. By God, see what kind of things they have attributed to a man like Hussein ibn Ali. Things the like of which we sometimes hear from the persons of a very mediocre character, who express a wish to see the wedding of their son or daughter in their lifetime. And this is said to have occurred at a time when there was hardly any respite even for offering prayers. They say that the Hadhrat said, "I want to wed my daughter to my nephew here and now, even if it is just an appearance of a wedding." One of the things that was an inseparable part of our traditional taziyas was the wedding of Qasim, the boy bridegroom. Such an episode is not mentioned in any reliable book of history. According to Haji Nuri, Mullah Hussein Kashifi was the first man to write this story in a book named Rozatu Shuhada, and it is totally fictitious. The case here is similar to the one about which the poet says, "Many are the appendages that they have clapped upon it, and you will hardly recognize it when you see it again." Were the Sayyid al-Shuhada to come and observe these things, and of course he does come from the world of the spirit, but where he comes into the world of appearance, he will find that we have carved out for him companions that he never had. For instance, in the book Murakkal Qulub, whose author was incidentally an eminent scholar and jurist, but who had no knowledge of these matters, that one of the companions to appear out of nowhere on the day of Ashura was Hashim Merkal, who came bearing an 18 cubits long spear in his hand. After all, had claimed that Sanan ibn Anas, who according to some reports severed the head of Imam Hussein, had a spear 60 cubits long. He was told that a spear could not be 60 cubits. He replied that God had sent it for him from the heaven. Murakkal al-Qulub writes that Hashim ibn Utbah Mirkal appeared with a spear 16 cubits long, whereas this Hashim ibn Utbah was a companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali and had been killed 20 years earlier. We have attributed several companions to Hussein ibn Ali that he did not have, such as the Zafar Jinni. Similarly, there are some names among the enemies that did not exist. It is mentioned in the book Asrar al-Shahada that Umar ibn Sa'd's army in Karbala consisted of 1,060,000 men. One may ask, where did they come from? Were they all Kufans? Is such a thing possible? It is all written in that book that Imam Hussein himself personally killed 300,000 men in combat. The bomb that destroyed Hiroshima killed 60,000 people. I calculated that if we assume that a swordsman kills one man every second, it would take 83 hours and 20 minutes to massacre a force of 300,000. Later, when they saw that this number of those felled by the Imam did not fit with a day's duration, they said that the day of Ashura was also 72 hours long. Similar things are said concerning Hazrat Abul Fadl, that he killed 25,000 men. I calculated that if one man were killed per second, it would require 6 days and 50 and odd hours to kill that many. Therefore, we have to admit that Haji Nuri, this great man, says that if one wanted to mourn the Imam today and narrate the ordeals of Abu Abdullah, may peace be upon him, one should lament over these new tragedies, over these falsehoods, which have been incorporated into the accounts of his martyrdom. Another example relates to the day of Arba'in. At the time of Arba'in, everyone relates the narrative that leads the people to imagine that the captives of the Imam's family arrived at Karbala on the day of Arba'in, and that Imam Zain al-Abidin met Jabir ibn Abdullah al-Ansari there. However, accepting the Lahuf, whose author is Sayyid ibn Tawus, who has denied it in his other books, or at least has not confirmed it, such an episode is not mentioned in any other book, nor does it seem very reasonable to believe it. But is it possible to expunge these stories which are repeated every year from the people's minds? Jabir was the first visitor to Imam Hussein's grave, and the significance of Arba'een is also nothing except that it is the occasion for the ziyarah of Imam Hussein's tomb. It is not for the renewal of the mourning for the Ahlul Bayt, nor on the account of their arrival in Karbala. Basically, the road to Medina from Syria is not through Karbala, and the two ways diverge from Syria itself.
که اتفاقا در میان وقایع تاریخی کمتر واقعی که از نظر نقل‌های معتبر به اندازه حادثه کربلا غنی باشند.
What is more painful is that incidentally there are few events in history that are as rich as the event of Karbala from the viewpoint of reliable sources. Formerly, I used to imagine that the basic reason for the proliferation of legends in this field is that the actual events are not known to anybody. When I studied and I found that no event of remote past, for instance of a period 13 or 14 centuries ago, has as reliable a history as the event of Karbala. Reliable Muslim historians have reported the pertinent episodes with trustworthy chains of transmission from the 1st, 7th, and the 2nd, 8th centuries, and their narrations are close and corroborated by one another. There were certain reasons which were responsible for the preservation of these details in history. One of them, which caused the details of this event to be preserved and its objectives to remain clear, were the many speeches, the khutbahs, that were delivered during its course. In those days, an oration was what communiques and press releases are in our ear. In the same way, the official communiques issued during wartime are the best historical source, so were orations in these days. Accordingly, there were many of them before the event of Karbala, during and after it. Individuals from among the Prophet's household made orations in Kufa, Damascus, and other places. Basically, their aim by delivering these orations was to inform the people about the episodes as well as to declare the truth of the matter and to spell out the goals. This was itself one of the reasons for the events to be reported. There were also many exchanges, questions and answers in the event of Karbala, and these are recorded in history. They too disclose for us the nature of the occurrences. Rajaz poetry was also recited a lot during Karbala, and in particular, Abu Abdullah himself recited much Rajaz, and these Rajaz verses also reveal the character of the confrontation. There were many letters that were exchanged before and after the episode of Karbala, letters that were exchanged between the Imam and the people of Kufa, between the Imam and the people of Basra, the letters that the Imam wrote earlier to Muawiyah, which indicate that the Imam was preparing an uprising after Muawiyah's death. The letters that the enemies wrote to one another, Yazid to Ibn Ziyad, Ibn Ziyad to Yazid, Ibn Ziyad to Umar bin Saad, Umar bin Saad to Ibn Ziyad, whose texts are all recorded in the history of Islam.
As the names that the enemies wrote for one another, Yazid for Ibn Ziyad, Ibn Ziyad for Umar bin Saad, Umar bin Saad for ابن زیاد، اینها چون متن اینها در تاریخ اسلام مضبوط هست، قضایای کربلا، قضایای روشنی و سراسر این قضایان افتخار آمیز است.
Hence, the developments of relating to Karbala are quite clear, and all of them are throughout a matter of great honor and pride. But we have disfigured this shining historic event to such an extent and have committed such a monstrous treachery towards Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, that if he were to come and see, he will say, "You have changed the entire face of the event. I am not the Imam Hussein that you have sketched out in your own imagination. The Qasib ibn Hassan that you have painted in your fancy is not my nephew. The Ali Akbar that you have faked in your imagination is not my aware and intelligent son. The companions that you have carved out are not my companions. We have fabricated a Qasim whose only desire is to become a bridegroom and whose uncle's wish, too, is to have him wedded. Contrast this one with the historical Qasim. Reliable sources report that on the night of Ashura, the Imam, peace be upon him, gathered his companions in a tent whose location was the place where water used to be kept or near it. There he delivered that very well-known sermon of the night preceding Ashura. I do not want to mention its details here, but to put it briefly, in this sermon, the Imam told them that every one of them was free to depart and leave him to confront the enemy alone. The Imam did not want anybody to stay just for the considerations of courtesy or to remain out of compulsion or even to think that they were obliged to do so by virtue of their allegiance, bay'ah, that they had given him. Hence he tells them, "You are all free, my companions, members of my family, my sons, my nephews, everyone, to leave without being liable to anything. They, the enemy's forces, have nothing against anyone except me. The night is dark. Take advantage of the darkness of the night and depart. They will definitely not stop you." At first he expresses his appreciation for them and tells them, "I am most pleased with you. I do not know of any companions better than mine and no better relatives than the members of my family." But all of them tell him in unison that such a thing was impossible. What answer will they give to the Prophet on the day of resurrection? What will happen to loyalty, to humanity, to love and attachment? Their ardent responses and their words said on that occasion would melt a heart of stone and are most moving. One of them says, "Is one life worth enough to be sacrificed for someone like you? I wish that I were brought to life 70 times to die 70 times for your sake." Another says, "I would lay down 1,000 lives for your sake if I had them." Another says, "If I were to sacrifice my life for you and my body were burnt to ashes and the ashes were cast to the wind, were this done 100 times, I would still love to die for your sake." The first to speak was the brother Abul Fadl, and then the Imam changed the subject and told them about the events of the next day, informing them that they would all be killed. All of them receive it as a great good news. Now this young man, Qasim ibn al-Hasan, to whom we are so unjust and think that all that he cherished in his heart was the wish to become a bridegroom, puts a question to the Imam. In reality, he expresses his real wish. When a group of elderly men gather in an assembly, a boy of 13 does not sit in their midst, but reverently stays behind them. It appears that this youth was sitting behind the Imam's elderly companions and was keen to hear what others said. When the Imam told them that they would all be killed on the next day, this child wondered if he too would be one of them. He thought to himself, "After all, I'm only a boy. Perhaps the Imam means that only the elderly would be martyred. I am just a minor." Therefore, he turned to the Imam and asked him, "Will I be among those who will be killed? Look, see what his wish and aspirations are." The Imam says to him, "Qasim, first let me ask you a question. I will reply after you have answered me." I think the Imam purposefully put this question. With this question, he wanted to show to posterity that they shouldn't think that this youth gave his life without awareness and understanding, and that they should not imagine that what he cherished was a wish to become bridegroom, and that they would not conjure up a wedding for him and be guilty of the crime of distorting his fine character. So the Imam said, "First I will ask you a question. That is, My child, my nephew, tell me, how do you regard death? And what do you think about getting killed? He promptly answered, It is sweeter to me than honey. That is, I haven't a desire that should be dearer and sweeter to me. This is an astounding scene. These are the things that have made this great and historic event, and we should keep it alive. For there will not be another Hussein, nor another Qasim ibn Hassan.
در ارزش میدهد که بعد از 14 قرن اگر یه همچه حسینیان به نامشون بسازیم کار نکردیم.
These are the things that make us give so much value to this event. And if after 14 centuries we build such a Husseiniyya as this, in their memory, in their name, we have done nothing. Or else the wish to become bridegroom does not oblige one to put one's time and money to build Husseiniyyas or to deliver sermons. But they were the very essence of humanity, the very concrete instances of the divine purpose, as stated in the verse, Surely I will make a vicegerent in the earth. And they stood above the angels. After getting this answer, the Imam said to Qasim ibn al-Hassan, My nephew, you too will be killed, but your death will be different from that of others. And it will be after you have faced a great ordeal. Accordingly, when Qasim, after much insistence, received the permission to leave for the battlefield, being very young, there was no armor that was fit for his years, nor a helmet, nor shoes, nor arms. It is written he wore a turban, amama, and this description is given of his appearance. He appeared like a piece of the moon. This boy was so handsome that when the enemy saw him, they described him as a piece of the moon. Where does the wind carry this petal of red rose? Said whoever that saw you on your fleeting mount.
راوی گفت نگاه کردم دیدم که بندی یکی از دو تا کفشاش باز است. یادم نمیاد که پای چپشم بود. معلوم نیست چپ نگاهش نبود.
The narrator says, I saw that the strap of one of his sandals was untied, and I do not forget that it was his left foot. This shows that he was not wearing boots. They write that the Imam stood near the tents as he held his horse's reins. Evidently, he was alert and ready. At once he heard a cry. It was Qasim. Ya Amma, O uncle. They write that the Imam flew on the horse like a hunting falcon. As he arrived by the side of this youth, about 200 men had surrounded this child. They fled as the Imam attacked, and one of the enemy's men who had dismounted to sever Qasim's head was himself trampled under the hooves of the horses of his fleeing comrades. The one who is said to have been trampled to death under the hooves of the horses was one of the enemy's men, and not Hazrat Qasim.
این جمله را از آقا شنیدم که فرمود یا اذ علا عمک ان تدعوه فلا یجیبک او یجیبک فلا یمسو.
In any case, when the Imam arrived at Qasim's side, there was so much dust and confusion that nobody could see what was happening. When the dust settled down, they saw that the Imam sitting at Qasim's side with his head in his arms. They heard the Imam utter this sentence, My nephew, by God, it is very hard on your uncle that you should call him and he should not be able to respond, or that he should respond without being able to do anything for you. It was at this moment that a cry came from this youth and his spirit departed towards its creator. O God, may our ultimate end be one that is of felicity. Make us aware of the realities of Islam. Remove us our ignorance and nescience with your grace and munificence. Give all of us the ability to act with sincere intentions. Fulfill our legitimate needs. Forgive all our dead and pardon them.